everyone, and welcome to another edition of Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk. I'm Dr. Meg Meeker, along with our host, psychologist, and best-selling author, Dr. James Dobson. And Dr. Dobson, today we're going to interview a man who has been involved in the pro-life movement for a very long time.
He certainly has, and this will be a very special day, Dr. Meeker. And with us is a man that I hope our listeners know already, and if they don't, they should. He is Thomas Glessner. He's a lawyer who has been heavily involved in pro-life work since the 1970s. That takes us almost back to Roe v. Wade, I guess.
Yeah.
And he began his career in Seattle after graduating from the University of Washington School of Law, where he practiced law for 10 years. Very early in his career, he became a partner in a law firm, which meant, in essence, that he had a little more time to work on outside things, and he began developing legal support for pregnancy centers. There's a lot more on this bio that I want to get into with him because it's all important to what we're going to talk about today. But Mr. Glessner, thank you for being our guest today. You started the first crisis pregnancy center. At least that's what I call it. You have another name for it, but Crisis Pregnancy Center in Seattle.
Yeah, it was the first Crisis Pregnancy Center in the Northwest. We opened our doors in 1982.
What led you to do that? Where did the passion come from? Because that was early on, and frankly, there weren't very many evangelicals, and you're one of them. I'm another, that were worried about that in the 70s.
Well, what happened was, you know, when actually I'm going to tell you a little story because it's so fascinating for me, and I think you and other fellow evangelicals might relate. I remember January 22nd, 1973. Most people can't tell me what they were doing there. I can tell you what I was doing there.
I was on a freeway in Los Angeles under a bridge. I know exactly where
I
was.
Well, then you and I are definitely two of a kind because I was a junior at the University of Washington. I was a political science major. My ambitions in life were to go to law school, enter the world of politics, and be elected to the United States Senator from the state of Washington. I'm walking across campus, January 22nd, 1973, and a fellow political science major runs up to me and he says, "Did you hear the news? Did you hear what happened today?" And I said, "No, what?" "President Johnson died." Okay, President Johnson, he wasn't president then, but he was a huge figure. And back then, the campus I was at was pretty far left radical. And as a government major, I was just interested in politics. So I ran back to my fraternity house, turned on the TV, and sure enough, there was a midday news report on Johnson. And then at the very end of that report, the anchor person says, "And in other news today, the United States Supreme Court invalidated the abortion laws of all 50 states in America." That was basically it.
By the way.
Wow. By the way.
Well, I remember thinking, who cares? Who absolutely cares? Now, I'm a young evangelical. I said, this doesn't affect me. I don't care. It's not going to impact me. And I remember thinking that. And that was basically the evangelical attitude, I think.
It not only was, but it agitated me because I did understand it. My father had made me aware of the implications of this, and I knew millions of babies would die because of it. But nobody seemed to care. Now, I wrote in a book that I just finished called Legacy that the following Sunday morning, the church where I was a member, its pastor didn't say a word about it. And he was a strong Christian leader, didn't say a word, nor did anybody else, unless you were Catholic.
That's the point. The only organized voice against it was the Catholic Church, but that allowed the other side to marginalize it. You must be Catholic. Okay, we understand. You know, so it got marginalized. And Protestants, evangelicals, for the most part, would say, "Well, I'm not sure about it. I'm uncomfortable with it, but that's a Catholic thing." Yeah. So what happened—
Thank God for them, by the
way. Absolutely. Yeah. My best friends in the world are Catholic brothers and sisters who have stood up on this issue for years. But So what happened was at the end of the 70s, if you remember, Francis Schaeffer and Sievert Koop and Mildred Jefferson did a book and a
whatever
film series,
happened
Whatever
to
Happened
to the Human Race.
That ignited evangelicalism. I was one of them. And my wife and I got really involved in. I remember thinking when it finally hit me, you know, everything we believe as Christians is on the line here. Because if we deny the sanctity of human life made in the image of God, then we've denied the purpose that Christ came. He didn't die for the animal life and the plant life and his creation. Yeah. He died for humanity because we're made in his image.
Yeah. Mm.
And that's so foundational to me. I just could not understand it. Why other people didn't see it that way. So we said, you know, it's one thing to be against abortion. We definitely are. But it's another thing to step out and let's do something positive and provide alternatives. So we founded that first Crisis Pregnancy Center then.
Meg, how about you? Where were you when you heard the news?
Well, I'm embarrassed
you were 12
to say,
years
I don't
old.
No, I wasn't 12. But I was in high school. And I don't remember. I mean, Roe v. Wade is a significant date in my mind now, but at the time it really wasn't. And I will tell you, I grew up in the Archdiocese of Boston, and I was very aware of pro-life work very early on because that was a big part of the Catholic Church. And now, as an adult and speaking out against abortion and speaking at the crisis pregnancy centers or the pregnancy care centers, it's always bothered me that pro-life conferences are dominated still by Catholics and not evangelicals. So as you're talking, I wonder, have we really made as much progress in igniting evangelicals to this issue as we should have?
My impression, and I don't have data to back this up, but evangelicals are now aware. They are coming together. They're realizing that they have dropped the ball, really, and had not spoken for the unborn child. Now, I don't know how many of them. I do know that the Planned Parenthood that I just mentioned that's very near to my house has picketers nearly every day out there on the nearby street. You can't get in close to the organization or its building. But now Catholics are there in 1 hour and evangelicals are there the next. I don't know why they don't come at the same time, but at least evangelicals are there, and for a long time they were not.
Well, and I would say, you know, the organization I head up, the National Institute of Family and Life Advocates, or NIFLA, is a legal network of now more than 1,300 pro-life pregnancy resource centers across the country. So this thing has grown dramatically over the years. And for the most part, most of those centers are supported by evangelical churches. They'll have Catholic participation in many of the centers, but for the most part, they're evangelical churches really supporting it. But I will say this, Dr. Dobson, the thing that I am concerned about is I don't see this message coming from the pulpits of the evangelical churches.
Yeah.
Now, the people are there, and you know, things like your program and other programs across the country, the people are really united, but pastors are still very timid on this.
I find that so difficult to understand when you consider that 57 million babies have been murdered, and we don't care that we don't talk about it within the church. This is not a political issue. That's the saddest aspect of this entire struggle is that people tend to see it as, that's just political.
Yeah.
Well, I share one story, and I don't share this. I'm not really proud of how I did it, but I was so frustrated. I was talking with an evangelical pastor, and he said, you know, Tom, we just can't talk about it because many women in our churches have had abortions and it'll just bring up some horrible memories. And I said, so you wouldn't preach against adultery because you're afraid that people are having affairs in your congregation and it'd make them feel guilty? I said it that way, and I'm kind of sorry I said it that way.
I think not. I think that makes a lot of sense.
Well, he jumped at me and he said, "That you know the two aren't the same." And I said, "You're right, they're not the same. Babies are dying." Yeah. But I felt I was a little—I was too harsh with him, and I later on apologized. I felt like that wasn't a way to talk to him.
I think the church should talk about it because women who are struggling with that and have that secret down inside that hasn't been resolved need the church to care.
They do.
An arm around it. Tell them that God forgives. There is no sin that He can't forgive. That's not an accusation. That is addressing a dark secret.
Yep. Absolutely.
And they know it's there. I mean, all women know it's there. And they're sitting in the pews and they're waiting for somebody to address this. I completely agree with you. Doesn't sound to me that you were harsh, but I wasn't there. But
well, I felt like, I have a little bit of a sharp wit sometimes, and I felt I could have been a little kinder. Maybe the tone of my voice wasn't real kind and it was not respectful. But I apologized later to him. But I think the point was right. I'll say one other story here that's related. Years ago, I spoke at a church in Baltimore on Sanctity of Life Sunday, and I had never seen this was I didn't even know that such a denomination existed. It was called the Reformed Episcopal Church. I had never seen a church so on fire on the pro-life issue. They had a pro-life committee. I met with them early before the service. We went out. I mean, everything was just incredible. And so I asked somebody, I said, would you please tell me how you guys got so committed on this issue? And he said, yeah, the pastor's wife a few years ago stood up and confessed that prior to being married, she'd had 4 abortions. Uh-huh. Now her husband knew about it, and she became a believer and all, but it was her dark secret. And when she confessed it, women started coming forward and sharing their stories. So they started post-abortion groups. And then men started coming forward. Mm. And men were weeping and confessing. And all of a sudden, true revival was happening in the church because this very dark, ugly secret was exposed.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Well, that is very moving. And again, let me go back to what you made reference to a minute ago. The National Institute of Family and Life Advocates, NIFLA.
NIFLA.
Okay. You head that up.
Yes.
And you started it. So tell me what it is exactly.
Well, I came to Washington, D.C. in 87. I was the president of the Christian Action Council, which is now known as CareNet. I left in the beginning of 93 to start NIFLA, to be a legal organization to provide pregnancy centers with legal counsel and guidance and preventive legal the advice, so to speak, because they've been under such brutal attack by the other side. A lot of those attacks were just, I mean, centers were making mistakes, but they weren't maliciously done. You just don't know what you don't know. So they need some guidance and some training and some education on how to do things right. So we started it. We modeled it after the Homeschool Legal Defense Association, my good friend Michael Ferris, who started that.
And mine.
Yeah, he's a wonderful guy. And we it's just sort of a small annual fee. We provide a lot of legal services for them. Well, what happened was in the mid-90s, we began to uncover that pregnancy centers were under such a brutal attack, lawsuits were happening, and they were getting restricted in their operations, and it was affecting their ability to attract abortion-minded women. But centers, and this happened out in California first, centers that converted their operations to medical clinics and began to offer ultrasound confirmation of pregnancy were reversing the whole trend we were seeing. They were seeing more abortion-minded women come in, and more of those women choosing life because they could see the unborn child on the ultrasound screen.
And you, I think, played a key role in forming the Life Choice Project.
Yeah.
And that was an organization to help get ultrasound equipment.
Well, what it is, it's not an organization. It's a program of NIFLA. To help centers convert to medical clinic status, do it legally. You're a real medical clinic under the legal guidelines that have to exist. And then to train your nurses and medical personnel on what's called limited obstetric ultrasound, which is under the medical guidelines from the medical profession, is a way that it should be done. And so we started the Life Choice Project and also a program to train nurses in limited ultrasound. And since that time, we've trained about 3,500 nurses who work at pregnancy centers and using limited ultrasound.
Wow. Mr. Glessner, is changing the status of a clinic from a pregnancy resource clinic to a medical clinic, does it change the funding or the ability to draw funds from different places?
Yeah, actually, you know, people get excited about this. If they know their money's going to some, first of all, let me talk about the ultrasound itself. Our stats show, and now we're gathering some really good information. We're going to go public with it in the fall because the centers are reporting. But it's very clear that 90% of the mothers considering abortion who see their child on an ultrasound screen will choose life.
Wow.
Now, when donors hear that, they come out of the woodwork because they want to support something that's effective. I do a lot of banquet speaking, and we show live ultrasounds on the banquet, and it's just amazing. People come up and say, wow, we wish we could give more. And you know, just a lot of things happen when a center gets that vision to go medical.
Mm-hmm. Wow. That's very exciting. Why do pregnancy resource centers, were they getting sued so frequently?
Well, the history of that is, I don't have time to get into my own personal experiences in Seattle with that, but we learned early on that the other side was absolutely brutal and vicious towards pro-life centers, slandering them. The conspiracy, and I'll use that word, came from Planned Parenthood in New York in 1982, where they hired a woman to undertake a project for the sole purpose of smearing and destroying, slandering, and closing down pregnancy centers. And of course, the line of attack is they're deceptive, they're dishonest, they illegally practice medicine, they lie to women about abortion. And Planned Parenthood launched this, and this was one of the reasons NIFLA came into being, because lawsuits were being filed, attorneys general in the 1980s were going after centers. And, you know, so Meg, I just have a thought about it, though. When a woman chooses life at a pregnancy center instead of abortion, guess who loses some money out of this?
Right. Yeah, exactly.
The abortion industry has lost millions of dollars because of the work of pro-life centers. And it just frustrates them to no end. They in the late 80s, had set a goal of 2 million abortions a year annually. And the Guttmacher statistics from 2011, now we're 3 years out, shows that while this number is appalling, it's still amazing. It's less than 1.1 million reported by Guttmacher in 2011. Well, I remember in 1992, Guttmacher was reporting approximately 1.6 million abortions. So half a million abortions less a year over a 20-year period. Now, we got a long way to go, but we are really having an impact, and they hate it. They've lost millions of dollars.
Yeah.
Dr. Meeker, before we went on the air, you were talking about the news that broke just recently.
Yes.
Regard to Planned Parenthood and Lila Rose. Exposed Planned Parenthood in a horrible scandal, and the America doesn't care about it. Heard it of one or two places. Let's expose it here.
Sure. I think that parents would care if they saw it. And I posted it on my Facebook site, Meg Meeker MD, and I posted it on myfamily.com. And what happened is she sent in a girl posing as a 15-year-old with a 17-year-old boyfriend. The boyfriend wasn't there. And she began asking the Planned Parenthood counselor how she could have sadomasochistic sexual relations with her boyfriend. And this lady went on to describe to her how she could use things like whips and be tied up. And it was so graphic that they actually had to bleep out a lot of what this woman was saying, talking about she said, well, how to get around the fact that she couldn't get into a porn shop because she was underage, but how she could get the boyfriend to get his friends to go in. It was absolutely horrific. I really even had a hard time listening to it. But here's this little kid. This little 15-year-old kid being counseled on things that are so abhorrent. And so I posted it, and parents need to really see this. Is every counselor in Planned Parenthood out there doing this? No, but it doesn't really matter, because the bottom line is our tax money is going to fund people who are engaged in this kind of thing. So, you know, I always feel the pro-life movement is a lot bigger than helping the unborn child stay alive, which of course is our ultimate goal. But I feel that when we're living in a culture which is so highly sexualized and it's normalizing bizarre sexual behavior, and I really think the agenda is for sexual freedom for anybody with any other person or whatever at any time. Sexual freedom is such a an American right, if you will. It's perceived to be an American right, that the pro-life movement needs to be much broader as well to prevent young girls from being sexually active so that they're walking into these Planned Parenthood clinics, so that they're being counseled for an abortion or on this horrible sex acts. We've really got to think of it in a broader sense, I think.
Meg, surely what you just described to us being done for and to a 15-year-old girl is illegal.
It's illegal. Surely
somebody is going to take action about that.
You know, they should. As a physician, I don't know why, and I've always wondered this, why there aren't lawsuits against, I know I'm going to get in trouble here, but against counselors like that and against those who are promoting things which are leading kids to very high-risk behaviors, like sexual activity of any kind when you're 15. And because physicians know this is wrong, they know it's medical malpractice, they know that people counseling this are leading kids into areas that are extremely physically and emotionally and mentally harmful to them, and why there aren't any lawsuits out there against this. And I wonder if it goes back to that silence. Why are evangelicals more silent than they should be? Why are pastors more silent on this than we should be? I don't know if it's a fear issue. I don't know if people, I think that when you talk about sexual activity and the results of that in children, adults, even well-meaning, rational, evangelical adults kind of get really confused in their thinking and back away much too easily, think, well, I don't want to be political, and so we'll leave that to somebody else.
Tom, you are an attorney. Answer the question. This is ultimately a legal question.
I wish I had a good answer. I think they're great legal cases to take. Number one, you have to have lawyers willing to step up to the plate and probably take something that they're not going to be able to make money on. And before I criticize the legal profession too much, I practice law and understand you got to get paid for what you do or you close your doors and you want to help when you can. But those lawsuits would be horrific as far as costs go, because you're suing a big, big entity that's going to subpoena all documents of the plaintiff. It's just going to be so I think there's a fear factor there. So I don't know exactly. I would like to challenge my legal friends listening.
Well, I understand what you're saying, and I do know the economics of it. But you got a 15-year-old girl here who is being abused in a dramatic way.
Well,
who's going to come to her aid?
Let me point out one of the great ironies here. On the other hand, the other side is suing pregnancy resource centers, claiming they're deceptive, they lie, they're pushing for legislation to close them down or restrict their operations. I mean, you know, what is wrong with this? Is something wrong with this picture we're talking about?
They have $500 million of federal money to operate with.
Exactly.
They're supposedly not doing abortions with that, but money is fungible, and who knows what it goes for. $500 million, half a billion dollars is going to that kind of activity.
Well, you're just talking about Planned Parenthood now. There are independent abortion clinics that are also making millions. So you're talking about probably well over a billion-dollar industry
and
right now.
And that's why they fight to preserve it.
Absolutely.
With everything they have. We're out of time. We've been talking to Tom Glessner about this issue, and we haven't gotten to what I most wanted to discuss with you, which I'd like to do next time if it's all right with you, having to do with the Declaration of Dependence.
Mm. My pleasure.
This is something that I support enthusiastically, and next time I'm going to ask you to describe it and tell us what it is. I do hope we'll have many of the same listeners and many more who will be motivated to sign on to this declaration because its time has come. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank
and,
you.
For what you've done, for caring about these children, and doing everything you can to limit or get rid of abortion altogether.
Well, and I thank you for the same thing, Doctor. You've been a great pro-life hero over the years.
Dr. Meeker, thanks for your participation today, and we will pick it up here next time.
Yes, we will, and I'm really excited about picking up the second part of the interview tomorrow. For all of you listeners out there, if you would like to find out more about the Declaration of Dependence, please visit our website, drjamesdobson.org, or call us, 877-732-6825. Thank you for joining us today, and don't forget to join us for the conclusion of our conversation with Thomas Glessner, right here next time on Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk.
Family Talk is not affiliated with Focus on the Family.